In the proposal that was written in preparation for these lectures, one of the things that we thought about, or I shouldn't say that we, because this was pretty much the work completely of Eleanor Rutledge, one of the things she thought about was the fact that people seem to have problems with poetry today. They are not sure whether they like it or not, and that came up several times in the previous lectures and readings. So I think it's quite appropriate that tonight I call attention to a few things that Larry Levis has confessed to in relation to his own poetry. First of all, he said that when he was running a tractor on the farms out in California, he memorized poetry just to drown out the monotony of the motor on the engine on the tractor. Secondly, he also points out that as a high school student, he preferred the pool hall to the classroom. And then he also, in some of his later poems, speaks about the fact that he dislikes increasingly sleeping, spending too much time sleeping. Well, so those may be some of the things that get in the way when we try to deal with poetry. Like Charles Wright, last week's poet, Larry Levis, does not consider himself a nature poet, but he has been very much affected by landscape, particularly the landscape of his youth, the landscape of the grapevine, and the plum orchards and so on of California. Like Gregor and Charles Wright, again, Larry is a personal poet, but again, he will say that he's not the confessional poet we sometimes find among the modern poets. His kind of personal poetry, we are told by one of the critics, reaches beyond the constraints of the merely personal and engages us in the collective struggles we all experience. And then, like Orr and Wright, he now makes his home in Virginia, having previously State University, the University of Missouri, University of Utah, I believe Iowa, and so on. He is now at the Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. His work has won him numerous honors, including three NEA fellowships, a Guggenheim fellowship, and a Fulbright fellowship, and maybe some others that I wasn't able to track down. It's indeed a privilege to have him participate in this series we have had on contemporary poetry. It was co-sponsored, I remind you again, by the Friends of the Handley Library and the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and Public Policy. Without any further ado, I give you Larry Levis.
Thank you very much. That's a very nice introduction. Thank you. I have one of these things strapped to my belt. I feel like an usher or a cop or something. Great. I'm going to read you a little poem about landscape. You know, I grew up around nature, if you want to call it that. Actually, it was agriculture, a science by which nature is held in check, I suppose. I grew up on a ranch in California where we made grapes, and we didn't make wine. We sold grapes to people like Gallo, who made bad wine from them. This is a poem called Some Grass Along a Ditch Bank. Nature was not exactly grandiose, I recognized, driving a tractor. Some grass along a ditch bank. I don't know what happens to grass, but it doesn't die exactly. It turns white in winter, but stays there a few yards from the ditch, then comes back in March, turning a green that has nothing to do with us. Mostly, it's just yellow or tan. It blends in, swayed by the wind maybe, but not by any emotion or partisan stripe. You can misread it at times. I've seen it almost appear to fight long and well for its right to be, and be grass. And when I tried pulling it out, I thought I could almost sense it digging in. Not with reproach exactly, but with a kind of rare tact that I miss sometimes in others. And besides, if you really wanted it out, you'd have to disc it under, standing on a shuddering case tractor and staring into the distance like someone with a vision in the wrong place for visions. With time, you'd feel silly, and always it comes back. At the end of some winter, when the sky has neither sun nor snow nor anything personal, you'd be wary of some impulse that seemed merely cosmetic. It's all a matter of taste and how taste changes. Besides, in March, the fields are wet. The trucks and machinery won't start, and the blades of the disc won't turn, usually because of the rust. That's when you notice the grass coming back in some other spot and with a different look this time, as if it had an idea for a peninsula, maybe, or its shape reclining on a map you almost begin to remember. In March, my father spent hours just piecing together some puzzle that might start up a tractor or set the tines of a cultivator or spring tooth right and do it without paying money. Those rows of gray earth that look combed between each row of vines and run off to the horizon as you drive past, you could almost say it was almost pretty. But this place isn't France. For years, they've made only raisins and a cheap sweet wine. And someone had to work late, as bored as you are, probably. But with the added headache of owning some piece of land that never gave up much without a mute argument, the lucky sold out to subdividers. But this is for one who stayed, and how, after a few years, he even felt sympathy for grass, then felt that turn into a resentment, which grew finally into a variety of puzzled envy, turning a little grass under with each acre and turning it under for miles, while his life spent on top of a tractor went by unnoticed, without feast days or celebrations. Opening his mailbox at the roadside, which was incapable of looking any different, more picturesque or less common, the rank but still blossoming weeds, stirring a little maybe as you drove past, but then growing still again. I'd like to read that poem, which is a poem, a wonderful poem about boredom and about how boring it is to live on a farm. But if you think it's boring to live there as a child, try doing it for keeps your whole life as an adult. That's a kind of elegy for my father who did that. Actually, I mean, farming and being in that area is beautiful, but it's not grandiose. I would like to read a little poem about a friend of mine. It's a poem called Caravaggio, Swirl and Vortex. I seem to have the weirdest glass, reading glasses in the world. I don't know why there is. Yes. And the left lens is foggy and the right lens is very clear. It must be that, you know. Christians have visions, Jews have eyesight. Caravaggio, Swirl and Vortex. I was in Rome once. I was on a Guggenheim, and I went to the Gallery Borghese to look at these Caravaggio paintings, and I was very impressed by them. And I finally wrote about them. I'm going to take off this jacket so I don't feel too much like. like somebody trying to be Cary Grant who can't. At any rate, I hope you don't mind this such informality suddenly. I was in Rome and I was struck by the Caravaggio painting of David and Goliath, which is actually a painting where David is holding Goliath's head up. He's just severed it. And the painting of Goliath is actually a self-portrait by Caravaggio, who was one of the bad boys of Italian painting. Got in a little trouble for things like murder. That will get you into trouble, by the way. If you're contemplating it, don't. In 1603 in Rome, he killed a man inadvertently, more or less, named Ranuccio Tomassoni. But actually, I don't write poems just about Italian paintings, because the Italian paintings are great. They are. But the self-portrait of Caravaggio reminded me so much of a friend of mine, Eddie Zamora, who died in Vietnam, who I went to high school with, and who went to junior college for 2 years but couldn't afford to go to college. So then was 1A classified, went to Vietnam, was killed there. So the poem skips landscapes, scenes quite quickly. It moves from Rome to the Haight-Ashbury district in San Francisco. I mentioned what other references do you need? Garcia, simply Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead, whose group used to play in the park there, Golden Gate Park. Poem finally winds up close to us in a way, at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, where I went years after my friend had died and found his name at the memorial. In the Borghese, Caravaggio, painter of boy whores, street punk, exile, and murderer, left behind his own face in the decapitated, swollen, leaden-eyed head of Goliath, and left the eyelids slightly open, and left on the face of David a look of pity mingling with disgust, a peach face, a death mask. If you look closely, you can see it is the same face, and the boy murdering the man is murdering his own boyhood. His robe open and exposing a bare left shoulder. In 1603 in Rome, that meant he was available for sale on the street where Ranuccio Tomassoni is falling, and Caravaggio, puzzled that a man could die so easily, turns and runs. Wasn't it like this after all, in this self-portrait, David holding him by a lock of hair? Couldn't it destroy time if he offered himself up like this, empurpled, bloated, the crime paid for in advance, to die before one dies and keep painting? This town and that town and exile. I stood there looking at it a long time. A man whose only politics was rage. By 1970, tinted orchards, mass graves. The song that closed the Fillmore was Johnny B. Goode as Garcia played it without regret. The doors closing forever and the whole hate evacuated as if waiting for the touch of the renovator, for the new boutiques that would open, a patina of sunset glinting in the high, dark windows. Once I marched and linked arms with other exiles who wished to end the war, and sometimes, walking in that crowd, I became the crowd. And for that moment, it was like entering the wide swirl and vortex of history. In the end, of course, you could either stay and get arrested or else go home. In the end, of course, the war finished without us in an empty row of horse stalls littered with clothing that had been confiscated. I had a friend in high school who looked like Caravaggio or like Goliath, especially when he woke at dawn on someone's couch. In early summer in California, half the senior class would drink and skinny dip after midnight in the unfinished suburb bordering the town, Because in the demonstration models, they filled the pools before the houses sold. Above us, the lush stars thickened. 2 years later, thinking he heard someone call his name, my friend strolled 3 yards off a path and stepped on a landmine. Time's sovereign. It rides the backs of names cut into marble. And to get back, one must descend, as if into a mass grave. All along the memorial, small offerings, letters, a bottle of bourbon, photographs, a joint of marijuana slipped into a wedding ring. You see, you must descend. It is one of the styles of hell. And it takes a while to find the name you might be looking for. It is meant to take a while. You can touch the names if you want to. You can kiss them. You can try to tease out some final meaning with your lips. The boy who was standing next to me said simply, "You can cry. It's okay. Here." Whistlers is what they call them. A doctor told me, who'd worked the decks of a hospital ship anchored off Seoul, you could tell the ones who wouldn't last by the sound, sometimes high-pitched like a coach's whistle the wind made going through them. I didn't believe him at first, and so then he went into greater detail. Some evenings, after there'd been heavy casualties and a brisk wind, he'd stare off a moment and think of a farm in Nebraska, of the way wheat bent in the wind above a slight rise, and no one around for miles. All he wanted, he told me, after working in such close quarters for 12 hours, for 16 hours, was that sudden sensation of spaciousness, wind, and no one there. My friend Zamora used to drink warm vodka from the bottle, then execute a perfect reverse half-gainer from the highboard into the water. Sometimes when I think of him, I get confused. Someone is calling to him, and then I'm actually thinking of Caravaggio in his painting. I want to go up to it and close both the eyelids. They're still half open, and it seems a little obscene to leave them like that. I have another poem about the 60s. Actually, this is a subversive poem and probably not very good for your health. It's called In 1967. It's perhaps remarkable, if only because it's one of the few pro-drug poems you will hear in this decade. It's called In 1967. Actually, I'm not advocating that anybody does this stuff, and I'll tell you why. But actually, I never had a bad trip on acid or mescaline or any of those things. Mea culpa, look, hey, I grew up in California in the late 60s. So dropping acid was sort of like de rigueur, you know. It was sort of like, you know, wearing low-top black tennis shoes at one point. You either did it or you felt like, why? Why am I not doing it? I'm going to get some. Anyway. And it was less expensive than low-top black tennis shoes, even then. Okay. Now, why shouldn't you do this? I'll tell you afterwards. In 1967, some called it the summer of love. And although the clustered, motionless leaves that overhung the streets looked the same as ever, the same as they did every summer, in 1967, anybody with $3 could have a vision. And who wouldn't want to know what it felt like to be a cedar waxwing landing with a flutter of gray wings in a spruce tree and then disappearing into it for only $3. And now I know. Its flight is ecstasy. No matter how I look at it, I also now know that the short life of a cedar waxwing is more pure pleasure than anyone alive can still be sane and bear. And remember, a cedar waxwing doesn't mean a thing qua cedar or qua waxwing, nor could it have earned that kind of pleasure by working to become a better cedar waxwing. They're all the same. Show me a bad cedar waxwing, for example, and I mean a really morally corrupted cedar waxwing, and I'll show you the cage they have reserved for you, resembling heaven. Some people spent their lives then having visions. But in my case, the morning after I dropped the mescaline, I had to spray Johnson grass in a vineyard of Thompson seedless my father owned. And so, still feeling the holiness of all things living, holding the spray gun in one hand and driving with the other, the tractor pulling the spray rig and its sputtering motor, row after row, I sprayed each weed I found that looked enough like Johnson grass, a thing alive that's good for nothing at all, with a mixture of malathion and diesel fuel, and said to each tall weed as I coated it with a lethal mist, Dominus vobiscum, and sometimes mea culpa, until it seemed boring to apologize to weeds, and insincere as well. For in a day or so, no more than that, the weeds would turn disgusting hues of yellowish orange and wither away. I still felt the bird's flight in my body when I thought about it, the wing ache lifting heaven, locating itself somewhere just above my slumped shoulders and part of me taking wing. I'd feel it at odd moments after that, on those long days I spent shoveling vines, driving trucks and tractors, helping swamp fruit out of one orchard or another. But as the summer went on, I felt it less and less. As the summer went on, some were drafted, some enlisted, in a generation that would not stop falling. A generation of leaves sticking to body bags. And when they turned them over, they floated back to us on television, even then, in the summer of love, in 1967. When riot police waited beyond the doors of perception, and the best thing one could do was get arrested. Cependant, sin embargo, that is not the best thing one could do now. The reason you don't want to drop acid now, those of you who are young enough to still want to do it in this audience, is not because it's bad for your health, or it's not because drugs are bad for your health, and it's not, you know, a moral thing. Moral schmoral. I'm getting awfully tired of that kind of crap. You know, basically, you know why you don't want to do it? They're going to bust you for that crap. You know? They've got laws against it. Watch out. That is my moral, social message for those of you who came only for that. At any rate. It's against the law. I'm going to read a poem that has nothing to do with anything. This is a poem in memory of two old teachers of mine who were wonderful people. One taught in a university, one taught in a coffee house. They taught beautifully, either way, in either setting or locale. They both knew a great deal about European literature. And as a young man working in the coffee house washing dishes, it was an education to work for that particular employer. And in the university, it was also an education to work for someone who now died of pneumonia. This is called Elegy with a Thimble Full of Water in the Cage. And it's actually, if you have any occasion to think of it, it's actually about the sibilant Kumai who was bothered by Apollo, and who protested to the gods, you know, her sort of molestation or rape or whatever by Apollo. And they said, well, you get one wish, and she asked for eternal life. And she asked for eternal life, but she forgot to ask for eternal youth as well. So as she got older, she sort of wrinkled and shrank into herself through the centuries. That's what this poem is about. Elegy with a thimbleful of water in the cage. The title of this. It's not only about her, it's personal as well. It's a list of what I cannot touch. Some dandelions and black-eyed Susans growing back like innocence itself with its thoughtless style over an abandoned labor camp south of Piedra. And the oldest trees in that part of Paris with a name I forget, propped up with sticks to keep their limbs from cracking. And beneath such quiet, a woman with a cane, and knowing if I came back, I could not find them again. And a cat I remember who slept on the burnished mahogany and the scooped-out beveled place on the counter below the iron grillwork, the way you had to pass your letter over him as he slept through those warm afternoons in New Hampshire, the gray fur stirring a little as he inhaled, the small rural post office growing smaller, then lost, tucked into the shoreline of the lake when I looked back. Country music from a lone radio in an orchard there, the first frost already on the ground. And those who slipped out of their names as if called out of them, as if they had been waiting to be called. Stavros lecturing from his bequeathed chair at the Café Midi in the old Tower Theater District. His unending solo above the traffic on Olive, asking if we knew what happened to the Sibyl at Cumae after Ovid had told her story, after Petronius had swept the grains of sand from it, how, granted eternal life, she had forgotten to ask for youth. And so, as she kept aging, as her body shrank within itself and the centuries passed, she finally became so tiny they had to put her into a jar, at which point Petronius lost track of her, lost interest of her, in her, at which point she began to suffocate in the jar, suffocate without being able to die, until finally a Phoenician sailor slipped the gray piece of pottery, its hue like an overcast sky and revealing it even less, into his pocket, and sold it on the docks at Piraeus to a shop owner, who, hearing her gasp, placed her in a birdcage on a side street just off Ammonia Square, not to possess her, but to protect her from pedestrians. And the boys of Athens rattled the bars of her cage with sticks as they ran past, yelling, "Sibyl, Sibyl, what do you want?" Each generation having to listen more closely than the one before it to hear the faintest whispered rasp from the small, bitter seed of her tongue as she answered them with the same remark passing through time, "I want to die." As time passed, as she gradually grew invisible, the boys had to press their ears against the cage to hear her. And then one day the voice became too faint. No one could hear it. And after that they stopped telling the story. And then it wasn't a story. It was only an empty cage that hung outside a shop among the increasing noise of traffic and from the square itself, blaring from loudspeakers, the shattered glass and bread of political speeches that went on half the night, and the intermittent music of strip shows in summer when the doors of the bars were left open, and then, Stavros said, the sun shone straight through the cage. You could see there was nothing inside it. He said, unless you noticed how one of the little perches swung back and forth, almost imperceptibly there. Though the street was hot, windless. Or unless you thought you saw a trace of something flicker across the small mirror above the thimble full of water. Which, of course, shouldn't have been there, which should have evaporated like the voice that went on whispering ceaselessly its dry rage without listening, without listeners. He said that even if anyone heard it, they would not have recognized the dialect as anything human. He would lie awake, the only boy in Athens who still heard it repeating its wish to die. And he was not surprised, he said, when the streets, the bars, the strip shows began to fill with German officers, or when the loudspeakers in the small platform in the square were, one day, shattered into 1,000 pieces. As the years passed, as even the sunlight began to seem as if it was listening to him outside the windows of the Midi, he began to lose interest in stories and to speak only in abstractions, to speak only of theories, never of things. Then he began to come in less frequently, and when he did, he no longer spoke at all. And so, along the boulevards in the winter, the bare limbs of the trees one passed in the city again became only the bare limbs of trees. No girl stepped into them to tell us of their stillness. We would hear rumors of Stavros following the gypsy Pentecostalists into their tents, accounts of him speaking in tongues. Glossolalia, he once said, which was all speech and none. In a way, it didn't matter anymore. Something in time was fading. And though girls still came to the cafe to flirt or argue politics or buy drugs from the two ancient boys expressionless as lizards now as they've been above a chessboard, by summer the city parks had grown dangerous. No one went there anymore to drink wine, dance, and listen to metal amplified until it seemed, as it had seemed once, the bitter, cleansing angel released at last from what fettered it inside us. And maybe there wasn't any angel after all. The times had changed. It became difficult to tell for sure. And anyway, there was a law against it now, a law against gathering at night in the parks was actually all that the law said was forbidden for us to do. But of course, it came to the same thing. It meant you were no longer permitted to know or to decide for yourself whether there was an angel inside you or whether there wasn't. Poverty is what happens at the end of any story, including this one, when there are too many stories, when you can believe in all of them, and so believe in none. When one condition is as good as any other. The swirl of wood grain in this desk, is it the face of an angel? Or the photograph of a girl, the only widow in her high school, as she decided to turn herself into a tree. It was a rainy afternoon and her van skidded at 60. For a split second, the trunk of an oak had never seemed so solemn as it did then, widening before her. Or is it misfortune itself for the little grimace the woman makes with her mouth above the cane, there, then not there, then there again? Or is it the place where the comparisons, the little comforts like the cane she's leaning on, give way beneath us? What do you do when nothing calls you anymore? When you turn and there's only the light filling the empty window? When the angel fasting inside you has grown so thin it flies out of you a last time without your knowing it, and the water dries up in its thimble, and the one swing in the cage comes to rest after its almost imperceptible, almost endless swaying. I'm going to stare at the world grain of wood in this desk I'm bent over until it's infinite. I'm going to make it talk. I'm going to make it confess everything. I was about to ask if you were cold, if you wanted a sweater, because, well, Stavros would say before he began one of those stories that seemed endless, the sun pressing against the windows of the cafe and glinting off the stalled traffic just beyond them. This could take a while. I passed the letter I wrote you over the sleeping cat and beyond the iron grillwork into the irretrievable. How much time do we have?
Quarter after eight. Okay.
That seems amazing. I've read all these poems in 15 minutes. When did this reading begin? Ten of eight. Okay. I'd like to read an elegy for my father, who was a farmer, a rancher. A poem called Winter Star. Well, it seemed, you know, like a strangely kind of distant and remote guy, you know, when I was growing up. Actually quite sympathetic, but so quiet. I mean, he didn't really, I think he wrote two letters to me. They both began, "House Tricks." I mean, he handled language as if it were a snake or something. He trusted more in things like wrenches and tractors and, you know, things like that. Your father doesn't have to be like you. He shouldn't be, probably. It would be difficult. He was quite brave in some ways. This concerns actually seeing him. I was with him in a pickup when we were driving along a country road near where I grew up, or where our ranch was. And I tend to personalize the fight that occurred. My father saw two guys. They were workers. They were what we call then Mexican, what you now call Hispanics or Chicanos in California. One guy had a coat wrapped around his arm, and the other guy had a knife and was coming at him. And he had one of those short, curved knives, grape picking knives, and you hold it there at the tip so you can slash it. You know, you razor sharpen it. So, you know, you can do a lot of damage slashing it like a razor. And my father said, "Wait here," simply said, "Wait here." He pulled off the side of the road. I'll tell you the actual background of his poem. He simply said, "Wait here." I said, "What the hell are you going to do?" And he walked right into the middle of them and said, "Look, give me your knife. You know, got a knife, give me your knife." You know, just like banished them to one side or the other of the road. Well, that was a long time ago. I think now you couldn't do that anymore. I wouldn't recommend it. So similarly to the way I wouldn't recommend you doing drugs, I mean, one of those guys would say, "Bese mi culo, cabrón," you know. "You die now, baby." You know. At any rate, times have changed since 1964. Mm-hmm. Winter Stars. My father died of Parkinson's and a series of small strokes and old age. My father once broke a man's hand over the exhaust pipe of a John Deere tractor. The man, Ruben Vasquez, wanted to kill his own father with a sharpened fruit knife, and he held the curved tip of it lightly between his first two fingers so it could slash horizontally and with a surprising grace across the throat. It was like a glinting beacon a hand. And for a moment, the light held still on those vines. When it was over, my father simply went in and ate lunch, and then, as always, lay alone in the dark, listening to music. He never mentioned it. I never understood how anyone could risk his life, then listen to Vivaldi. Sometimes I go out in this yard at night and stare through the wet branches of an oak in winter, and realize I am looking at the stars again, a thin haze of them shining and persisting. It used to make me feel lighter looking up at them. In California, that light was closer. In a California that no one will ever see again, my father is beginning to die. Something inside him is slowly taking back every word it ever gave him. Now if we try to talk, I watch my father search for a lost syllable as if it might solve everything. And though he can't remember now the word for it, he is ashamed. If you can think of the mind as a place continually visited, a whole city placed behind the eyes and shining, I can imagine now its end, as when the lights go off, one by one, in a hotel at night, until at last all of the travelers will be asleep, or until even the thin glow from the lobby is a kind of sleep. And while the woman behind the desk is applying more lacquer to her nails, you can almost believe that the elevator, as it ascends, must open upon starlight. I stand out on the street and do not go in. That was our agreement at my birth. And for years I believed that what went unsaid between us became empty and pure, like starlight, and that it persisted. I got it all wrong. I wound up believing in words the way a scientist believes in carbon after death. Tonight I'm talking to you, Father, although it is quiet here in the Midwest, where a small wind the size of a wrist wakes the cold again, which may be all that's left of you and me. When I left home at 17, I left for good. That pale haze of stars goes on and on, like laughter that has found a final silent shape on a black sky. It means everything it cannot say. Look, it's empty out there and cold. Cold enough to reconcile even a father, even a son. Quite serious poem. Well, anyway, let me turn to something a little more bizarrely political, I guess. This is a poem called Poem Ending with a Hotel on Fire. I was in Cincinnati once, and I was staying, after a reading, I was staying overnight in this hotel, and the guy who was my sort of host, Jim Cummings, who's a poet, who's written a long Sestina sequence, book Sestina, he said, "How was your night?" And I said, "Oh, fine, except for the fire." He said, "The fire?" I said, "Yeah, there was a fire in the hotel, and we all went down to the lobby, and we went down to the bar in the lobby, I guess, and, you know." And he said, "You know, I envy you. Everything always happens to you. You know, nothing ever happens to me. It always happens to you." And I said, "Yeah, sort of wish it would stop, frankly." So at any rate, it was the occasion of this particular poem called Poem Ending with a Hotel on Fire. There's some references in here that you don't really need to know much about. The Italians are a reggae band. I used to shoot pool with them in the Midwest. They were much better at pool when I was. Their music is also much better than any music I could possibly play. Poem Ending with a Hotel on Fire. Very spacey political poem. Hope you don't mind. Poor means knowing the trees couldn't care less. Whether you carve the initials of your enemies all over the trunk's white bark, or whether this sleep beneath them is your last. In the contorted figures meant to represent their sleep, the statistics never show the deep shade in the park. The mother appearing in the dark of someone within whose sprawled arms clear gin and black tar mingle to compose the blood's unwritable song. The poor are wrong, say the blackening church bells, the traffic stalling on the bridge, the lazy swirl of current underneath it all. What I love is the way you would whisper against the current into the dark. This is the woman speaking about it. But what you mean by poor is some figure in concealment by which they are forgotten. The figure itself is a kind of poverty.
I don't mean just money. I mean poverty in the widest sense of, widest possible sense of the term. There was a sound of crickets in a ravine I listened to so closely one evening, it became only a vast chirring. Then a thing not there. Then the roar of a fire. It was like being or pretending to be without speech. And to be without speech means no one's listening. And the flames scaling the neighborhood like mirrors, they're not even pretending to listen. This is why the poor are not permitted to see themselves. This is why money mirrors nothing so accurately it tempts us to look for our reflections in the passing leafy idol of a water so toxic by now. It would scald you if it were real. For what is engraved upon it still represents a wilderness or a flashy green silence almost alive in the palm of your hand that stands for one. And what secessionist keeps whispering in your ear? And whose eye, removed from a human face, stares from the pyramid like a biceps inscrutable tattoo? And what mansion floats in its mosses and a landscaping so thick you cannot pick out the slave snoring or dead or holding a towel to his head where an ear had been in the shade of the willow there? Once in a hotel in Cincinnati, I saw a woman decorated, not a bride, but like a kind of human Christmas tree in money. All down the buttons of her blouse, and in fact all over her blouse and skirt, the men for whom I heard later she had been hired as a private dancer, had pinned 20s, 100s, 50s, rolls of smaller bills. And as the alarm blared, and its one note, in the bass and smoke, billowy, calm signature of whoever had set the upper floors on fire, began filling the corridor, we arrived at the elevator in the same moment and waited. I in shorts and a faded t-shirt with three naked Jamaicans on it who were once the Itals, and she in the most expensive dress I'd ever seen. And when the elevator didn't show, we ran down the steel and concrete stairs that rang and rang with our steps. And later in the lobby bar, her purse so stuffed with bills, the bartender simply said, "It's cool," and raised both hands above his head when we tried to pay. She would talk only of her one obsession, which had nothing to do with money, nor with men, or swaying to music, but with purebred Abyssinian cats. The trouble she went to taking them, traveling with four howling cages behind her in the back of a station wagon to shows all over the Midwest. The worst part, though, she said, was that the shows were rigged. The judges were paid off. So every winner, she had exhaustively researched all this, she told me, every winner descended from families that had arrived on the Mayflower. And did I know, most of America was in the control of people who spent whole afternoons daydreaming, running combs through these Siamese and long-haired Persians' fattest sofa pillows. No kidding, I said. And did I read about how they tried to frame her in Chicago? Do I look capable of murder one? She turned to me, the glint in her eye revealing nothing. No, I said, but what about murder two? Isn't that just the same thing done with a lot more feeling? In her laughter, you could hear leaves scraping the cold streets if you listened for it, if you listened hard enough. The fire in the hotel that began as nothing more than the prank of a child who'd gotten high after school by inhaling gasoline fumes in a vacant lot and who then rode, with a gas can carried in a paper bag, the elevator to the Starlight Terrace restaurant, where he'd looked beyond frayed tablecloths and over the entire city before a waiter picked him up by his long hair and shoved him into an open elevator within which falling solitude the boy splashed gasoline over the fake wood paneling and plaid carpet, stepped out of it two floors later, and then, with that quick and graceful turning gesture from which the body makes the thoughtless beauty of a hookshot from forecourt, tossed a match inside before the door could close. And though it took the fire crew less than an hour to clear two floors and put the last sparks out, I kept thinking of the elevator descending to some small family, probably in from the sticks, probably on their way to visit a dying aunt or sister, who, after blowing all their savings to stay in a room decorated with the overcast melancholy of a cheap Utrillo print, waited there in the fatigued dignity and aftertaste failure had left them with, as if to think it over, in that moment when the doors opened onto flames. In the photograph she showed me, the Abyssinians looked emaciated, and though I couldn't say why, like a species that had survived its own extinction, their pale eyes suggested nothing at all. They looked back like the face of famine, their thin, ridged spines older than even the ancient illustrations of cats on tombs, cats that had been the pets of kings and now slept beside them in the straight-jacketed, dry whirlpool of bandages they had wrapped kings in so that they might descend without distraction. Did the doors of tombs open onto flames? The faces of the cats caught in the photographs there would never tell. Their gray fur was like the blurred print or the blank churring blizzard on the TV set above the bar. Nothing would tell. Once in a blizzard in a foreign city, having lost my way, I wondered what it would be like to be one of those blind, drunk, high, or homeless who would have no alternative except to freeze to death, and thought how, after the initiation of pain, they say it is like being lulled to sleep. The way the snow appears to faint as it swirls in the locked doorways of shops, the way this would be the last thing that appeared to you there, before whatever was left of you became gradually confused with a small part of the upsway of snow and wind. This is all a matter of confusing yourself with something else. The soul curls up in the doorway and lets the snow swirl around it. And not just money then, but poverty, I thought, in the widest possible sense of the term, would be, but then I knew what it would be. For a moment, I could hear the cats howling in their steel cages, their thin spines turning in circles. Tattoo on a forearm and shriek of the wind, and no figure drawn in the night silent contemplation by which the poor might be forgotten. And not you beside me in the dark, but only a dry fern and a Bible in the room, the rain beginning its long descent onto the roof, its sound the churring of crickets in a ravine. I could almost hear, no, I could only imagine hearing it. And that is what it would be, to have to imagine everything in detail, without end. Thank you very much.